Welcome back to the Dear Katie podcast. This is Katie Kessner.
And this is Claire Kaplan. As our listeners know, sometimes the discussions we have on our podcast are pretty difficult to hear. And so we want to make sure that any of you, but especially survivors of trauma, receive the support you need for your safety and well-being. So please reach out for emotional support from family or friends, you know, counselor if you have one, or any other resource. Additional information and resources can be found on the Take Back the Night Foundation website, and we will give you that address at the conclusion of our podcast.
Thank you so much, Claire. And today we're so excited to welcome Erin. And as we always do, Erin, you know, we love to hear a little bit about your bio, so we know your background, where you grew up, a little bit about your family, and where you are right now in life, and kind of the journey before we talk about your story. So where are you now, and where have you been?
All right. Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. As you said, my name is Erin, and I'm originally from North Carolina, and I just retired from the Army after 27 years this past October. And so I am living in El Paso, Texas right now, married with one daughter, and we are here in El Paso for a couple more years. I'm going to let my daughter graduate high school here because it's not fair to move her again. She's pretty much moved every 2 years of her life since she was born. And once she finishes school here, we are heading up to Colorado to retire there.
Okay, great. So your daughter is what year in high school right now?
She'll be finishing up her sophomore year in a couple weeks.
Great. Wow. And what branch of the military were you in?
I was in the Army. I was enlisted, and I was a medic, and 27 years. I meant to only join for 4 after high school just to do something different, and that 4 turned into almost 3 decades.
My wow. Goodness. Thank you for your service, Erin, for sure. So let's, you know, go to the important question that all of our listeners want to know is, you know, what's the survivor experience that brings you to your microphone? What happened?
Like I said, I was raised in North Carolina. My parents divorced when I was 5 years old, so back in the 80s. And it was myself, younger brother and younger sister, and my mom. She did the best that she could. She, being a single mom at the time, she worked as a behavioral health nurse at a facility for troubled teens. So it was pretty common for her to come home with bite scratches, bruises. But thankfully, my grandparents, her parents, my maternal grandparents, lived just down the road. So they took me in, and my grandfather pretty much raised me until I was 13. He passed away. And of course, when he passed away, they left a hole in my heart in looking for that male role model. And it was in 1991, I was 14, I had a job as a waiter at a restaurant, and I met a middle school teacher there. He wasn't a teacher at my school, but he was within the same school system. And he had a way of having kids gravitate towards him. By that time, he had been teaching for almost 30 years. So not only teaching the current generation, but most of their parents also. And he showed a genuine interest in me, you know, during breaks or when I had time off. For a year, we'd literally just talk. I'd go to his house a lot. He'd sit in his chair and I'd sit in mine, and we'd talk about everything under the sun, from music to movies to books, the meaning of life, and nothing inappropriate ever happened. And fast forward to a year after that, in August of 92, 24 August of 92 to be exact, I went to his house that morning, something I'd done countless times before in the previous year. And I don't know if it was something that he planned or an opportunity that he took, but that morning he raped me.
Wow. That's a big statement, Erin. Can we, before you tell us about that, I think it'd be helpful to hear, did you have siblings or you had 2 parents at the time? You know, maybe just a little more context. So you're only 14 at this point?
Yeah, I met him when I was 14, and the attack happened when I was 15. Mm-hmm. And so he basically, this teacher stepped in and became that mentor that I needed. And looking back now, you know, being only 14, 15 at the time, I was happy someone was paying attention to me, you know, showing a genuine interest in me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a little more educated eyes now. I am the same age now as he was then. Wow. I knew that I know that he was grooming me. And
yeah.
looking back now, I can see that. But like I said, back then, I was just happy that he was there for me. And right. He was my friend.
Right. And you needed that. You needed an adult figure to provide that kind of mentoring.
I did, you know, with my mom working and, you know, us being Generation X, you know, latchkey kids, we needed someone to look after us, and that mentor, and he filled the shoes very well.
And I'll bet even your mom was really glad that you had found someone. You know, it's the pressure on her being a, you know, the kind of work she did. She probably was grateful to have
him
in your life.
Yeah, she was. She knew about it. Of course, I told her about him, and she was just grateful that, hey, this man is able to step in and fill in those shoes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, looking back, I would think that she'd be uncomfortable that I was going to this man's house. He wasn't married. He was single. But at the time, she never showed any concern or any type of warning. It was just, hey, this man is here for you.
Aaron, I'm curious about something before you go on. Like, before you go back, do you think there were any warning signs that your mom could have known about or not? You know, you mentioned one, he's single. But back then, like, there was no knowledge or discussion about this.
Right. Well, I always I talk about my experiences now, and I always say that, you know, looking back, as I said, a little more educated, you know, I find now that his likes and dislikes, for example, in music, and, you know, in late 1991 and 92 was a grunge and alternative. I was heavy into that, being a teenage boy at the time, and his likes and dislikes began to closely parallel mine quite a bit. From that year on, and looking back, I can see now that, you know, he was gaining my trust, and once he had that trust and I was in his grasp, he knew that he could, in his eyes, anyways, do no wrong.
Mm. So now we have this first experience, but then you're 15. What happens next for you, Aaron?
For me, like I said, after the attack, obviously I was in shock, and I got home afterwards, and I wanted nothing to do with him anymore. His grasp on me, at least physically, had ended that morning. A couple of days later, I received an apology letter in the mail. He hand wrote a letter and sent it to me. And even though it didn't state anything specific about the attack, you can tell something inappropriate was going on between this adult and this minor. I read it once. I wanted nothing to do with him anymore, and I promptly threw it away. And a couple hours later, my mom had found this letter in the trash. I didn't tear it up. And she approached me and she asked me straight up, did he touch you inappropriately in any way? And that day, shame became my prime motivator. Mm-hmm. And I told my first lie because it had already set in, because I was taught, you know, especially growing up in not only American society, but American Southern society, that another man lays his hands on you, you're not a real man. Mm-hmm. So you keep those emotions to yourself.
Yeah.
And I said, no, he did not touch me. We simply got into an argument, and that's what he was apologizing for. And she did not bring it up again. And as life does, it went on. I finished up high school.
Aaron, I have a big question. That was huge. Wait, you skipped, like, you're going through decades. But when I love digging in on what you were talking about, you said, I wasn't a real man in society at this point if a man lays a hand on me. Tell me more about that and what it meant to you and where you learned it. Do you recall, like, you know, was that part of religion? Was it part of culture? Was it part of your parents? Like, where were you getting all that messaging about, like, I'm not a real man if a man lays a hand on me?
It was definitely from not only culture, but definitely pop culture and religion. I was going to church at the time just because my mom was making me, and hearing all these things about, you know, homosexuality and how it's a sin and you're weak, basically. And if you cannot take care of yourself because another man laid his hands on you, then how can you take care of your family?
What was the expectation if a man laid his hands on you? Like, do you punch him out? Do you kill him? Like, I'm curious. Like,
yes.
I'm not a man, Aaron. You're telling
right.
me a lot.
No, the expectation, at least to me anyways, was you had to fight for yourself. And, you know, back, we all know a fight or flight.
Yeah.
And my response at the time was freeze. It was neither of those.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm not a big person. I'm only 5'6". And back then I was only maybe 100 pounds soaking wet.
Oh, wow.
And yes. And I feared for my life. My only thought at the time was, okay, I don't know why my friend is doing this, but I need to survive the situation.
Wow. Right.
And so I froze because my body couldn't do anything else. And I just wanted to get out.
Sure.
So I always tell when I speak about this that, you know, I've heard countless survivor stories, as I know you have. And a common factor that I found is many survivors do not remember the exact details of their attack because the mind shuts down.
Right.
I was the exact opposite. I remember every detail of that attack.
Oh, wow, Aaron. That's huge.
Because my body froze, but my mind stayed. Mm-hmm. And my only thought during was survival. I didn't know if he had a weapon. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what would happen afterwards. I just needed to get out of there. So once he finished, I stumbled on his porch, and next thing I know, what I don't remember is how I got home afterwards. I got on my bicycle, and next thing you know, I'm on my own front porch. But yeah, I mean, we talk about how in our society that men simply cannot be raped. But
right.
We all know, obviously, the opposite is true. But even the most acceptable rape joke in the world is, for example, going to prison, don't drop the soap type thing.
Yeah,
because mm-hmm. you will be overpowered by another man. And if you are basically, for lack of a better term, the bitch.
Yep.
Yeah, so powerful, Aaron, what you're telling us. I have another question, and Claire might have more. So after that experience, how did you navigate not seeing, how did it end? Like, what did you tell your mom? How did you say, like, I'm not going over there again? Or what happened next?
I was an introverted kid to begin with, so obviously this put me into my shell even more. And he stopped going to the restaurant. He knew what he did was wrong. So that was the last time that I saw him physically, but mentally he kept that hold on me. And it just kind of, you know, with you know, my mom asking about what happened, it just kind of faded away. By that time, you know, I was in school and keeping busy. I was in ROTC and swimming, so that kept me busy. So I was able to use those as excuses because, honestly, they did take up a lot of my time. And between that and work, I was able to, more times than not, try to keep my mind off of it. But every single day, that attack stayed with me.
Yeah, I'm sure it did.
When you say that, how did that come to be? I'm thinking nightmares. Was it like what were the consequences with every single day?
Yeah, a lot of it was mistrust of authority at that time, because this was a teacher. This was a pillar of the community. And I knew that I was within his power. He knew I wasn't going to say anything. Who's going to believe this 15-year-old kid, this 15-year-old boy, basically, against this man, this teacher who everyone knows? And basically, this is a shame that I kept internally for over 17 years before I finally sought help that I desperately needed.
Wow.
So, Aaron, you kind of covered things up with your mom, even though she kind of wondered, and you just plowed forward with your life. What prompted you to go into the military? Because it's a very physical kind of thing.
And you bring up my mom, and there's actually a great part of my mom during that same time that I'll bring up later on when I'm getting ready for this trial, basically, when I turn him in. But to answer your question now, you think that with the military, you know, with it all being authoritative, that it would be something that I couldn't excel in because of that. But by then, after a couple years, I had pretty much was able to gain my trust with authority figures again. And with my mom, she was former Navy. I always wanted to be in the medical field, and I received a scholarship for nursing in the Army, but by the time of graduation, even though I did pretty well in school, I wanted to do something else. And that's why I joined the Army, and which was only supposed to be for a few years, which turned into a career. But even when I was in the military in the late 90s, before Iraq and Afghanistan kicked off, seeking help at behavioral health at that time was a stigma. Yes. You were seen as a detriment to the force, as a weak link. So I was able to keep my professional and personal life very separate for a very long time. In the mornings, I'm that perfect soldier standing tall. But in the evenings, you know, I'm that kid who's 15 again, who's crying, who's trying to figure out what's going on, something that happened years prior. And instead of turning to drugs or alcohol, what I did was cut, basically. So my upper arms, my upper legs. So when I wore shorts and a t-shirt, you couldn't see. And that was my way of trying to gain control of my body to feel again, because this man still held control over me.
Thank you for bringing that up, the fact that you were trying to deal with your pain through a form of self-harm that is so common, so common. And I thank you for mentioning how you would do this in places where it wouldn't necessarily be seen, because so many people who do cut, they do it exactly that way. They do it in areas of the body where most people wouldn't see it.
Right. Yeah. Because the last thing I wanted to do was, you know, be seen as a troublemaker and needed to go to behavior health. So I was able to hide it very well.
And of course, being seen as potentially unstable would affect your military career.
Yes. You know, we're taught from day one, at that time anyways, you know, over almost 30 years ago, that, you know, you could potentially lose your security clearance or even be kicked out at the time. So that had always stayed with me, even after the wars kicked off and with the rise of PTSD and seeking help at behavioral health, the stigma was slowly dying away. I still had that mentality of seeking help was seen as a weakness.
And yes, and unfortunately it still is to a certain degree, though I think, yes, a lot has changed, but it's very hard for folks in the military to reach out for that kind of help.
It can be. I mean, we'll push our bodies and we'll hurt ourselves and we'll refuse to even seek help for that because we want to be the ones that are, you know, strong and be able to push through. And sadly, people pay for that years and decades later.
Yes. Well, thank you for talking about that, bringing that issue up. So when did you actually figure out that you might need to reach out for help for your healing process?
This was thrust upon me. My body had forced me to. Going to fast forward now a little bit. I'm married now. I have a daughter who's the one who's going to graduate soon. And you know, after spending a couple tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, as a medic, I've seen the worst that man can do to each other and the best that they can do in the same situations simultaneously. And I've held the hands of people who have breathed their last. I was the last face they saw before they passed on. And what I witnessed in combat never bothered me as much as what happened that August morning back in 92, because I was trained to deal with death, with this grief, but no one is trained to deal with rape. It's just not possible. And so that was always on the back of my mind. And fast forward now to January of 2010, I'm driving down the street one evening, and I don't know if it was a sight, a sound, or a smell, but something had triggered my mind in such a way that caused me to have a nervous breakdown. I called my wife, who, by the way, did not know this had happened to me. This woman who I'm spending my life with, I still had that shame inside of me, and she had no idea this had happened to me.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, so thank you for answering that question. When you say you had a nervous breakdown, what did it look like? Like, what was happening to you?
Yes, I started to, you know, uncontrollably shake and cry out of nowhere. I had to pull over, and I realized that this is my body telling me you finally need to seek help. This is over 17 years after the attack. I'm now in my early 30s, and my body told me you need to seek help now. And that next day, I'm enrolled into an inpatient behavioral health facility, and I tell my story for the first time to a group of strangers. I took my first step towards recovery. And as, you know, as cliche as it sounds, it was the weight of the world lifted off my shoulder. And ever since that day in January 2010, every day I wake up and I continue to take that first step towards recovery, because, as you know, it's a process.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Wow. That took so much courage to do that. And how did your wife, did you tell her what you thought was going on? Did you explain it? And or what happened?
I told her what happened, and she has been my number one supporter ever since. She understood. I thought, you know, with me hiding it, that it'd be the opposite, but it wasn't the case. And thankfully, she has been there ever since. And
it's fantastic.
It is. And, you know, I finished the program, and just a couple months later, just out of curiosity, I researched the statute of limitations for statutory rape in North Carolina. It turns out there were none, and I had no physical proof. This is 17 years after the fact. It's my word against his, and I decided to call the local police, tell them my story, and see if something can be done. And I told them my story. I gave them a written statement. They said, if anything pops up, we'll let you know. And like I said, I wasn't expecting anything. But at least I have done something in my mind to, you know, to take that first step towards justice. And just a few days later, that next week, I received a phone call, and he was sitting in the local county jail under $500,000 secure bond for statutory rape and taken indecent liberties with a minor. Because it turned out that during the course of their investigation, they found in his teaching file the letter that he wrote me, and the dates on that letter corroborated with the dates that I gave the police.
Because
it turned out that after my mom approached me with this letter, she knew something was going on. She wasn't satisfied with my answer, so she went to the school board. And like I said, even though nothing specific about the attack was mentioned, you could tell something inappropriate was going on, not only between this minor and this adult, but this student and this teacher within the school system. And so they fired him, or, you know, he was allowed to retire. And this was way back in 92, and my mom had never mentioned this to me, and I did not find out until the investigation in 2010. And this woman, who I had told my first lie about this attack, went to bat for me and was my hero. And sadly, by the time that we found out, she was already on the decline for early onset dementia. She now has full-blown Alzheimer's. So I was never able to thank her properly for what she did, but she never brought this up. But she went to bat for her little boy.
Wow. Good for mom.
Yes.
Well, Claire, and oh my gosh, this has been amazing, Erin. I think we should, you know, think about what we want to hear from Erin. Maybe it's PTSD and how you navigate that, and maybe thinking about, you know, what your own next steps are.
Basically, like I mentioned before, seeking help at the time in the late 90s was a stigma. But with Iraq and Afghanistan going on, with the military in combat on two fronts, with PTSD on the ride, that's, you know, as I said, that stigma was slowly dying away. But I was finally able to seek help. I still do. In fact, I have an appointment in a couple of days, and I'm still on medication for it. But you know, it's just to spread that message, to give people that moral courage to stand up and do the right thing. Because we see every day in the news, you know, a survivor standing up and, you know, years or decades later. And we as a society, we victim blame, we put them down. Well, why were you wearing that dress? Or why was he drinking when he's only 18? Why'd you put yourself in that situation? And this sets a precedence for everyone else who wants to stand up and do the right thing. They feel that, well, I don't want my livelihood destroyed as this person's was. So I'm going to basically sit down and keep this to myself. And sadly, as I did for so long, and as so many others, silently live in shame. And so this is why I tell my story, to give others that moral courage to stand up and to help organizations create that climate and culture of moral courage, where standing up and speaking out and doing the right thing is not met with retribution and is not punished.
You've spoken to a lot of different groups. You've spoken to fellow soldiers. How have you been received?
Actually, I've been received pretty well, actually. I've been speaking in the Army now since around 2015, and now that I'm retired, I'm reaching out to colleges and universities for the same thing, since the demographics, age-wise, at least those coming in around the same, about, 18 to 22. Yeah. And even though my attack did not happen in the military, you have so many that do, sadly, with initiations and hazings, the same as colleges. And even just down the street from me, in the next state over, New Mexico State University, the basketball team has had issues over the last couple months with, sexual abuse going on in the locker room. Because as a society, we are taught that these locker room antics are okay, but as soon as they join an organization such as the military, they get in trouble pretty quickly because they find out that this behavior is not okay in the military, but it's still okay with you growing up. So it's changing, how we raise our children and what's acceptable and what isn't as far as sexual assault, abuse, and molestation.
As you think about what needs to change, I want to harken back to the stigma around men.
Sure.
And stereotypes of men. How much of a role do you think that, the imposed silence and stereotypes about what men, should or shouldn't talk about or do or not do, gender stereotypes, how much does that play in your mind? And I would flip it over, since you have a daughter, how much does it matter that, women are supposed to be seen and not heard, or, what role should we play in flipping some of these stereotypes about gender?
Well, sadly, we're still dealing with the double standards of gender. For example, you read in the paper that a teacher, had consensual sex with a female minor, as well they should be, they are crucified. But if the same thing happens, we reverse those roles. If a teenage boy is having sex with a female teacher, basically they give him high fives and call him a player. And it's, sadly, that's always been the case as far as genders are concerned. And, we've taught our daughter, we're not helicopter parents even after what happened, but we told her from an early age, this is what your genitalia is called. And we didn't use nicknames as we do, because we as Americans were afraid to talk about sex. We see it as unclean, as impure, as evil. And just spending a few years in Europe, in Germany, more specific, seeing how they treat sex and are open about it, people aren't afraid to talk about it. And when your own child is afraid to come to you with those types of questions, and we rely on the educational system to teach our children, I think that creates issues, because that boundary of communication is closed simply because we don't want to have that uncomfortable conversation, but it needs to be done.
Well, where do you think you are now in terms of your healing process? And what would you like to share with our listeners, the listeners who may be silent out of shame, or they've grew up the same messages that you did, the gender stereotyping that men, if there's something wrong with you, if you're a man and this happened to you, even if you were a little kid, but a teenager, whatever, what would you like to say to them?
I like to tell them that you are not alone, that help is out there. You do not have to suffer in silence, but I encourage you to seek that help, whether it's, anonymous through the phone or seeing someone in person. But we have to break away that stigma that seeking help for behavior health is a weakness, when in case, you hurt yourself, you break your arm, you're going to see a doctor, you're going to take care of it. But if we have a glitch in our brains, we feel that's a weakness if we see help when it should not be. We simply need to take care of ourselves, and I implore them to do so.
Well said.
Well said, Aaron. Definitely.
Thank you.
Yeah, perfect. Anything else, Claire?
Not from me.
Oh my gosh. So, Aaron, I think, you share with our listeners such a beautiful and powerful journey all the way through, seeking help, seeking justice, overcoming gender stereotypes, and now where you are in terms of, you know, mentoring your own child and going forward. So my goodness, thank you for sharing all of that with us. We so greatly and kindly appreciate it. And I turn it back to you just for a second. Is there anything else you want to share with our listeners?
If you're interested, I can be reached at www.1818winters.com, and I can be contacted through there. And, you know, basically, if you are out there suffering in silence, I implore you to seek that help, because sadly, I have known those who refuse to seek it. And it's, in the end, sadly, they've taken their own life. My story is an anomaly. You know, I have a somewhat happy ending, but speaking to people about my story and spreading my message is a way of therapy for me, and I will continue to do so as long as people will continue to listen.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Aaron.
Thank you, Aaron, again, for sharing your story with us and with our listeners. We're all grateful to you for that. And also we're grateful to our listeners who joined us for this episode of Dear Katie Survivor Stories. Again, if you need support but don't know where to find it, visit takebackthenight.org for a list of resources and how to reach our legal support hotline. And you can help other survivors by subscribing to our podcast and sharing this episode or any other episodes with your social media contacts. Please consider posting it on your social media, as I said, and make sure to follow us on ours. Dear Katie is completely produced by a fantastic group of volunteers. So thank you to all of them. And thank you again, listeners, for being present today. And always remember, self-care is essential to healing and to thriving.
Thank you so much, Claire. And again, thank you, Aaron. And my last comment to our listeners is, continue to take this healing journey with us, and we look forward to welcoming you to another Dear Katie episode. Take care and be well.